The conference is now being recorded.
Good morning, and welcome to the NAOS Asset Management Limited Investor Conference Call. I would like to introduce your host for your conference call today, Sebastian Evans. Thanks, Sebastian. Please go ahead.
Great. Thanks, Ali, and good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Quarter Two FY20 Investor Conference Call for NAOS Asset Management and the subsequent three LICs. Just an admin question: if my speaker or microphone does go funny, just please let me know somehow. I'm sure someone's on here who's got my mobile or email address, and I'll try and fix that straight away. You would have seen the materials were lodged with or lodged on the ASX this morning. I believe they've all been emailed out as well. So I'll be running through this presentation with Ben Rundle, who's sitting next to me. And to kick it off, I'll start on slide three. Obviously, this information is a little bit repetitive, but as there's quite a few people on the call, I will just touch on it to provide a little bit of background about NAOS. So for those of you that don't know, NAOS started with its first listed investment company in 2013 with 400 shareholders and about $17 million in FUM. Today, we manage roughly $300 million on behalf of about 7,500 shareholders. Clearly, you know, we're aligned with all of our shareholders. All of my personal funds outside of my home are invested in the three LICs, along with other directors, employees who have a very significant stake as well. And it's also worth noting that we have a very strong ESG process, and we recently signed up finally to the United Nations Principles of Responsible Investments. And as you would have seen on the next slide, we're very cognizant of our portfolio and its ESG process that we apply to all of our investments. On slide four, just really looks at our investment beliefs. As most of you would know, we invest for the long term. Most of our investments are held within the fund for many, many years. Some have been with us for 7 years. We're a highly concentrated investor. We believe in the quality of the business and the quality of our information as opposed to the quantity of investments. Because we're a closed-end fund, we don't need to invest in many investments just because they're illiquid. We can take a view based on the business and not the liquidity of its shares. We don't follow the index. We mainly invest in industrials, so no mining, no early stage technology, no consumer finance. And as I've said, we've got a strong ESG screen, and our alignment is very strong for our own LICs, but we look for the same thing across all of our investments. So a lot of our investments tend to be founder-led businesses, where they have a lot of equity alignment with just ordinary shareholders. On slide five, this just gives you a illustrative a chart of, I suppose, our performance since inception. As you can see, we've been going since FY13, and obviously as the different coloured column starts, that represents a new fund. Pleasingly, after a poor FY19, FY20 has started very well for all of our funds. As you can see there, NCCs are up 17.5% to December, NACs up over 20%, and NSCs up over 19%. For me, I think it's just really a reflection of our investment strategy obviously paying off. If you look at our long-term track record, it's very strong. It's in excess, in NCC's case, of more than double the index return. But obviously, we will go through periods where we may underperform significantly. But if we believe we're in the right investments, over time these investments should re-rate accordingly and our performance should adjust, hopefully very strongly to the upside, as we've seen in FY20, and pleasingly that performance has continued. Slide six just touched on the risk-adjusted metrics. Obviously, we get investors telling us all the time that our portfolios would be what they would consider to be high risk. But as we can see here, you can see when you look at risk and return, we've shown that our performance relative to our risk is much stronger than the index over the longer term. So our downside deviation is less than the index, yet our returns are significantly higher. So I think it's a little bit of a furphy that just because you run a concentrated portfolio means you have a much higher risk, or you're taking a much higher risk exposure to the index. On slide seven, I've really just started with some market commentary. And I think very topical. In the office this morning, we were talking about Tesla shares. If anyone's a Tesla shareholder, clearly you've done very well over the past month. They've gone from almost $200 12 months ago to over $960 this morning. And for me, it gives you a really just a really clear picture of where we are in this environment, what we're trying to deal with. So the ASX 200, for those of you that don't know, was up 23.5% for calendar year 19. But the interesting point is that earnings growth was just 1%. So when you look at what's driven returns at an index level, it's really been valuation. So you can see the PE of the market, excluding resources, has increased from 13.8 times to almost 22 times. So what people are willing to pay for a business has gone through the roof, and therefore the index has gone through the roof, with the majority of the earnings of the gain that you've made after that coming purely from dividends. And what you've seen and what we continue to see is that investors across Australia and across the globe are really grappling with how to invest and how to allocate assets when cash rates are at record lows. We continue to see a flood into commercial property, shares, ETFs, anything that derives some sort of income, and now people are looking for more, I would say, speculative investments that have a significant amount of potential capital growth, but also a significant amount of potential capital risk, in my view. And you can see by that chart, the market was had, in our view, minimal volatility, albeit the gains were significant. When you look at the micro level, I suppose the domestic economy, a few things have clearly changed from where we were 6 months ago. One of the big things that has changed is the credit contraction in housing loans is definitely eased over the past 6 months. These charts from the RBA chart pack that was released in late January shows you that, interestingly, owner-occupier loans have definitely bounced. So it's starting to get easier to get an owner-occupied loan. But interestingly, if you're an investor, investor loans are still at record lows since 2003. So the property market, again, is driven by people looking for new homes to live in or upgrade to. And what that means is, in our view, it gives people confidence. People want to renovate. They feel good about, obviously, their house price and where they are in life. And potentially, they feel better about spending money on discretionary items. Everyone was expecting, 2 or 3 months ago, everyone would have expected the RBA to cut rates yesterday. Obviously, they didn't. And a big reason for that is unemployment has been very strong. The unemployment rate is now 5.07%. But if you talk to anyone, and obviously running this business, it is very hard to find good people. But at the same time, people aren't getting the wage increases that they're used to or have been used to over the past decade or so. And that really drives a lower confidence level. People don't have the confidence to, offsetting that, I suppose, house price piece is the fact that they're not getting more money in the bank through a wage increase over a 12-month period. And just on the last point, the federal budget is a little bit more topical lately, but it is interesting to note that, with the budget coming up in May, a lot of what is driving the New South Wales economy and the Victorian economy has been stimulus driven by the state and the federal government. We believe the budget remains in reasonable shape, especially when you look at the iron ore price and what was used to forecast the budget originally 12 months ago. But at the same time, offsetting that is much lower taxes through consumption and potentially even things like, property prices and things like that. But in our view, and a good chart that highlights this, is if anyone's been through the CIMIC result that came out last night, we always look at the chart that shows you the amount of work that is scheduled to come to fruition over the next 5 or so years. And if you look at transport, the amount of money being spent on transport infrastructure over the next 5 years, that chart continues to rise. And I remember doing my presentation 3 years ago expecting it, to taper off and fall. But the chart just continues and continues to rise, especially now with, things like in Sydney, you've got the new harbour tunnel that's scheduled to be built, inland rails, probably the biggest project of them all. We continue to have more metro projects in Sydney. There is a lot of money being spent on infrastructure in New South Wales. And now, pleasingly, things like Cross River Rail in Brisbane, and obviously the new tunnels, which are causing people a few headaches in Melbourne. Most people will know we're going into reporting season for about the half year for all of our investments across most of our funds. But interestingly, in January, interestingly, to be honest, January and December were very busy for us with a lot of businesses making either acquisitions or releasing earnings guidance for the year earlier. And what I think what we've really realised is that, yes, you know, a lot of companies remain on, I suppose, valuation highs, whether it's technology stocks. If anyone's looked at the technology stocks of late, things like Altium, you know, Afterpay, Appen, they're all back to their record highs. But interestingly, we've seen a few downgrades from businesses that used to be very well owned and, I suppose, market darling. You know, some good examples of that. NIB, the health insurance business, finally succumbing to pressure in the health insurance market, which, you know, obviously less and less people are getting health insurance, and their ability to push back on costs is finally looks like it's, you know, running out of steam. That stock's down almost 20% since their downgrade not long ago, you know, less than, you know, a few weeks ago. You know, the other standouts were, you know, Kogan, a business that's been in vogue for a long time. You know, interestingly, they've been able to grow revenue at a very fast pace, but what they've shown us is that revenue is growing, but it's not as profitable as it once was. So their gross margins have been crimped. So now there's questions around the sustainability of that business model and how profitable it can be. And if you were in that business going into that update, you've lost almost, or you've lost over a third of your capital. And the other one that probably fits within that basket as well is Newmap, you know, a business that was a market darling for a long time. Unfortunately, we were short and we closed it out too early just to minimise our capital loss on the way up. But really, a one-product company, in our view, that probably doesn't have a significant competitive advantage to some of its peers. But this is all relative to valuation. This is a business, I think, at one stage got close to a $1 billion valuation. And they've come out and said that, albeit they expected their growth rates to be significant, they've come out and said that, you know, later in the year they lost a couple of customers. You know, their ability to sell the product effectively and into new markets has been slower than what they expected. And the amount of cash this is taking up has been significant. And it looks like, you know, they may get to a slight cash crunch over the next 6 months if things don't go according to plan. So it doesn't leave them with a lot of fat in their own balance sheet. And then you've seen the shares fall 30%. So as I'm saying in my month-end commentary that comes out later or next week, is it really doesn't matter what business you're in, whether it's retail, contracting businesses. It's interesting to note that the two businesses here that have had the biggest fall are actually were the market darlings. It's supposed to be, you know, in vogue, being Kogan and Newmap. It really comes down to earnings and what you're paying relative to those earnings multiples and the quality of those earnings streams. The businesses, you know, reporting season for us generally is, you know, is the most important part for all of our LICs because we don't tend to hear from some of our businesses for a long time. I've tried to give you a rough idea of some of the more important ones we're looking for. You know, clearly BSA is a big one. For those of you that don't know, the service stream result is out later tonight, I believe. And we'll be looking at that very closely, just looking to see how they're going with NBN volumes, how the maintenance is going with NBN. I sent around an email last night to my team in my suburb where I am, NBN's down, and they gave me a log of all the work that's been completed, so I can tell you if you're looking at how many technicians are sent out and at what time and for how long, you know, there will continue to be a lot of maintenance spend on NBN to get it up to scratch, even post its build-out phase. You know, over the wire, after a poorly received 19 result, you know, they'll be looking to put any concerns to bed and really show the market that they can continue to grow organically and that their product and their service offering continues to resonate. And then a new position for us, but a position that we've been in time and time again, Smart Group Corporation. So a business that's essentially halved, I suppose, since its highs. A new managing director, but a managing director who's been in the business for many years as CFO. Really needs to put a lot of, you know, I suppose, answer a lot of questions around organic growth rates, their balance sheet, which is should be net cash, but how they can drive earnings going forward and arguably what's a tougher environment for them. But in our view, at 10 times with a net cash balance sheet, it's priced for, in, I would say, almost complete disappointment. So touching on the funds, I'm going to do NCC and then I'll let Ben do the other two funds. Yeah, NCC went through a very, I suppose, busy period for quarter two. So as you would all know, or hopefully you all know, CML Group's been a core position for us for six years probably. It's an invoice financing and factoring business. They received a merger proposal or takeover proposal from one of our other positions, being COG, or Consolidated Operations Group. Obviously, we were supportive of that deal until Scottish Pacific, which is a big private equity-owned business, lobbed a 60-cent share cash bid, which at this stage is indicative and subject to due diligence. What's happened since then is COG have taken a 20% share in CGR. I will say that NCC has sold out a majority of its position, so we have a very, very, very small position left in that business. And we really don't know how this, I suppose, takeover will end over the coming months. But from an NCC point of view, it's been a very strong contributor performance over the long term of the fund, and just as importantly, over the last quarter, and now it's been removed from the fund. Saunders, which has probably been one of our worst performing businesses for the last couple of years, announced at the AGM that they expect an improved result, which many would argue is not hard to do considering the previous result was so poor. But a few industry things that we started to pick up on later in the year were that one of Saunders' major competitors called CBNI is owned by a US-run business called McDermott's. McDermott's made a very large acquisition 2 years ago to defend a takeover, and unfortunately for them, they've run into a lot of contracting issues. And subsequently, McDermott's entered Chapter 11 bankruptcy very early in January. What this means to the industry is that it removes one of the three competitors for the time being. And for the other competitor being EBZ, I would suggest people to go and have a look at their recent financial guidance, which came out yesterday, which was forecasting a loss for the half year. And we would argue that have a very stretched balance sheet. So from an industry perspective, the industry should really be the best it's ever been for Saunders, hopefully over the next 12 to 24 months. And going into January, people would have noticed that Saunders, after 2 years of a hiatus of winning any major work, have recently won a $15 million contract with Sydney Water for a new reservoir that's being built in Sydney out at Liverpool. And then they won another contract in excess of $30 million to replace and maintain 16 tanks at a Rio Tinto facility. And then finally, they put out guidance as well, which shows them returning to profitability at margins of 5%, which we would argue should have plenty of scope to increase, considering the revenue base is quite small. So pleasingly, we've seen the stock re-rate from 25 cents closer to 50 cents in the past few weeks. And then finally, our smallest position by size or company size, BTC Health, not known really by anyone, but really put out some guidance later in the year saying that they expect revenue growth of 15% with a steady gross margin. So still a subscale business, but operate in an industry that we think has some excellent tailwinds. And if they can continue to add new hospitals and new products to their bow, then it should continue to see good organic growth, hopefully improved gross margins. And the market is huge when you're looking at medical devices and that distribution into hospitals in Australia and New Zealand. It's a very big market that will only continue to grow, especially as hospitals and health insurers look for more efficient and lower cost and more effective ways to treat patients so they don't have to stay in hospital any longer than they have to. Touching on the portfolio, just more really statistics. So the NTA is $1.12. The share price, this is all at the 31st of December, was 103.5 with it roughly a 5% cash weighting. The performance for quarter two was roughly 0.4%. Now, the average market cap of the stocks in the fund is 90 million, and that's weighted by the size of each position. And the historical dividend yields 7% fully franked, so you can gross that up. But pleasingly, our profit reserves remain healthy at roughly 25 cents a share. So if you figure we're paying a bit over 7 cents a share, that gives us at least 3 years of dividend reserves prior to our January performance. So with that, I'll pass it on to Ben to touch on NSC and NAC.
Thanks, Sebastian. Good morning, everyone. So starting with NSC, some of the key portfolio events for the quarter, M&F Group, which is the largest holding in the fund, completed a $50 million institutional placement at $5 per share. The reason for the raising was to pay down all their debt and give them the optionality to fund international growth initiatives and potentially acquisitions going forward. So Rene, who's been running that business for a long time, particularly prides himself on running a conservative business. The capital raise probably came out of the blue for some. However, we feel that it strengthens the company and gives him that optionality to act quickly on a growth initiative, despite what the prevailing market conditions look like at the time. Importantly for M&F, the tailwinds remain significant. One example is recently a company called Spokephone, who is a customer of M&F and uses their network. They're a mobile-based voice company, and they recently announced a successful tender for a large commercial insurance provider. So the growth of that business is just one example of the type of business that's powering the growth of the overall M&F group. So as it stands, the business trades on about 17 times FY21 earnings with a very strong balance sheet and a very capable management team. If you look at that, particularly in light of where the rest of the market trades and also in particular the rest of the technology sector, we still view that as very cheap and, as I mentioned, has the optionality to grow via their strong balance sheet. The second event was in Enero Group. The CEO, Matt Melwish, announced his intention to resign by the end of March 2020. Matt's done a fantastic job of restructuring the entire Enero Group and streamlining the business to what it is today. And so even though it's a significant loss for Enero, we believe the risk is mitigated somewhat as all of the large agencies operate as independent silos and have their own management teams. There's also on top of that a significant depth in the overall EGG management team. We've met all of the key CEOs of the individual businesses. We think they're very capable and very high performers. And we do think that despite the loss of Matthew and the efforts that he has put into Enero over his time running the company, we don't think that there's significant risk to the business from losing him going forward. The tailwinds for Egg, we believe, remain significant, particularly for Hotwire and Orchard. They both operate in the technology and healthcare space, and it's an industry whereby success begets success, and that's what we're seeing in Enero at the moment, where the more they're winning, the more people want to work for them, and the more work they end up winning on top of that. So the company at the moment has it's on about 11 times earnings. It has a very strong balance sheet. We still feel it's a little bit undiscovered by the rest of the market, and we continue to be happy holders of the stock, and it's been a fantastic performer for NSC since inception. And then the third position there, Eureka Group, which is quite a new position to the portfolio. They operate and build senior living villages. They announced their first acquisition in over 2 years, acquiring a 124-unit facility in Bundaberg. Eureka is a group that we came across. It has a little bit of a checkered track record insofar as that the previous management team misallocated capital and I guess lost their way a little bit. However, that's been significantly cleaned up over the last 12 to 18 months, and that's given Eureka the ability to internally fund further acquisitions, which they've done so with this Bundaberg acquisition, by selling some of their non-core assets. And it also gives them the ability to reduce debt through cash flow, resulting in a potential EBITDA uplift of over 15%. So we were able to buy that business at below book value, and we do think that the book value, as stated in the accounts, is very conservative and is potentially at risk of being revised upwards at some stage. Turning to slide 13, just some of the statistics around the portfolio. So the pre-tax NTA of NSC at the moment is 85 cents. The share price is a little lower at 75. We are relatively fully invested with only a 4.5% cash weighting at the moment. We have an ongoing buyback program, which has bought just under 8 million shares back to date, which has been significantly accretive for the NTA for all shareholders. The dividend yield is 5.3% at the moment, and we have about 16.5 cents worth of profit reserve. So we in Q1, we announced a 1 cent quarterly dividend. NSC pays its dividends quarterly. So you can see 16.5 cents gives us over 3 years' worth of dividend capability. Turning to slide 14, the NAC portfolio. So some of the key events there, Objective Corporation, which is a business that we own and have been quite public about, they announced in the middle of January that they were expecting an operating profit that's expected to increase by close to 24%, and importantly, recurring revenue as part of that profit is around 75% of the total. So one of the things that attracts us to the Objective Corp business at the moment is the fact that the company has been through a significant transition of moving from a term license model to a software as a service business. And what that does is significantly increase the recurring revenue nature of the business, and for us, significantly improves the quality of the overall business. They expense 100% of their research and development spend, so the accounting is very, very clean. And at the AGM, they provided more commentary around potential acquisitions, which could be funded out of the $34 million net cash balance sheet they have at the moment. So it's a business that we really like. The company has a very long track record of operation. The management are highly aligned and don't pay themselves a fortune like some other small companies do. And they're very high quality. The return on capital metrics are very good. Their cash flow is very strong. And as I mentioned, the accounting is very clean too. So a business that we're happy holders of for the time being. The second event was in a company we own called Molus Australia. They announced the acquisition of a 50% stake in South Australia's largest shopping centre, Marion Westfield, for $670 million. That is part of an institutional mandate with a company called SDH REIT, which is a large real estate investment trust listed in Singapore. And so we look at that as a significant endorsement of the Molus management team in their ability to not only attract a mandate from offshore, but also deploy it in what we think is a very smart acquisition. The second acquisition they made during the period was the completion of a special purpose vehicle to acquire the freehold and operating rights to the Beach Hotel in Byron Bay. That's a significantly strategic asset which we think there is further development upside, and we think it's a smart acquisition by the company. And so the assets under management for Molus will be close to $5 billion. And we also think that the corporate and advisory business is performing very strongly at the moment. So, again, it's a company that we really like at the moment. We think that the management team is first rate. They are very well aligned and significantly, I guess, don't pay themselves a huge amount of money. They take their pay via dividends paid through the stock, which aligns themselves further with shareholders. And then finally, Smart Group Corporation. So Sebastian mentioned it briefly before. It's a company that we've known for a long time. The share price has fallen from about $12.50 to a low of $6.80, or I think even touched lower than that over the past 3 months. There's been a few negative announcements which has caused that. The first was that the resignation of Devon Billimoria, the highly regarded managing director of the company who's been there for about 17 years, the exit of a large founding shareholder, and together with about a 10% earnings downgrade due to changes with their insurance provider. So three probably quite significant negative announcements from the company. However, we feel at the moment the share price has overreacted to those events. And at the moment, the company is trading on about 11 times earnings. It has a very strong balance sheet, a very impressive level of cash flow. And we do think that the incoming CEO, who has previously been the CFO of the business, Tim Louie, knows the business very well and is very competent and capable of taking the business forward. Turning to slide 16, just on some of the metrics, the pre-tax NTA of the portfolio at the moment is $1.18, so that's at the end of December, versus the share price, which I think is about $1 at the moment. We have 9 holdings and 1 short holding. That short position has now been removed. Probably worth noting as well that the short position wasn't us taking a view on a company falling. It was just a hedging position which we used to neutralise another holding which we had an escrow period on. We currently have 16.5 cents worth of profit reserves, so you can see that provides us with close to 3 years of dividends going forward. And to date, we've bought back over 3 million shares in the company as well to try and reduce that discount. So with that, I'll hand back to Sebastian. I can finish off the capital initiatives.
Right, thanks, Ben. Just finishing off the slides with just some more holistic views about capital management and the funds themselves. I think this is important for all shareholders. The things we try to focus on as a business and for our shareholders, clearly the most important variable that we focus on and try to improve at every day is performance. We want to invest in businesses that compound shareholders' capital year in, year out over the longer term, and we want to minimise any potential of permanent capital loss, and that's what we continue to do without deviating from our philosophy. Clearly, we want to grow our dividends to shareholders, which we have done so in NCC and NAC, and we obviously look forward, hopefully, to doing in NSC. We've done that for over 7 years now, and we clearly have a very healthy reserve balance. We want to be aligned with all of our shareholders. We benefit just as much as you, hopefully, when the LICs perform well, and obviously hurt just as much when the LICs do not perform as expected. Communication is a very important piece. We want all of our shareholders to understand what we're doing and why, and why mistakes occur and what our thought process was behind that, and obviously when investments perform very well, you know, why they have done so and why we made those investments in the first place. And then in regards to the fund specifically, I think it's important to note that, you know, clearly we did an option, a small option issue in NCC. Over 10% of those options have been exercised already. You know, pleasingly, after the January NTA report is released, you know, those NCC options will be very much well in the money. And with a bit of luck, that should be able to get NCC to 100 million, which we've said will soft close because, you know, for us, that's a special fund. That's our first fund, and it operates and invests in very small businesses. So we want to make that, leave it at a size that's, you know, marketable, but at the same time gives it enough flexibility to continue to invest in that space effectively. In regards to NSC, it was a busy period. We've been very active on the buyback. You know, pleasingly, we bought a lot of those 7.7 million shares well below NTA. And then, pleasingly, we were able to repay those listed convertible notes, which we inherited, and we've replaced them with a lower cost non-dilutionary unlisted note offering. So we did a $27 million note offering. They have a five-year term. They don't convert to equity, and they have an interest rate that's sub 5%. So it gives us certainty over the funding of the LIC and really removes any distraction going forward. And hopefully over the next 5 years, the fund returns generated will be substantial and therefore will give us the funds needed to repay those notes if that is the best use of shareholders' capital. And then finally, NAC. Clearly, it's had a very strong start to the, well, calendar year 19 was very strong. It was its second best year on record with a 28% return. Probably the one that's not as well known as the other two LICs, but probably has been the best performer with NCC. And, you know, as we've said, it's probably the most illiquid of the two, but we've been able to buy back 7% of the shares on issue, which has been very accretive to shareholders, considering we probably bought most of those shares back at 80 cents, and the NTA today is probably closer to $1.20. So it has been very accretive, and the fund size actually hasn't shrunk at all. If anything, it's probably increased slightly given the performance. Just one final point. You'll see that we've released our investor roadshow dates. The one thing that is different this time is we've added two new cities due to demand from some investors. So we will be presenting in Toowoomba this time on Wednesday, the 1st of April in the morning, and we'll also be presenting in Hobart on the 6th of April. So I believe it's up on our website. You can RSVP, and there'll be a more formal announcement on the ASX later, I think actually tomorrow.